The Cassini spacecraft has captured some striking images from flying by three moons of Saturn, including new pictures of gushing geysers on Enceladus. It's an amazing story. You'll find it at coasttocoastam.com. Up next, of course, our science advisor and head of the enterprisemission.com with some incredible stories, all things space, Richard C. Hoagland, next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie, a man who really needs no major introduction other than his name, Richard C. Hoagland, enterprisemission.com, our science advisor. How many shows have you been on, Richard?
1,000, 2,000.
At least.
One loses count after the first 100 years.
Absolutely. Well, you've been such a staple of the show. You really have.
Commercial noted.
I was thinking... Today, when we were looking at your material and everything else, just how important you've been to the show for so many years and how you have literally captured our imagination in the wee hours. There have just been so many shows from, you know, the beginning with Art, and I've been so fortunate to be able to have you with us these last 10 years. It's amazing. It's gone by so fast.
It's 10?
10 years already.
It's 10
yeah.
years?
Yeah.
Good
yep.
grief.
I know. Where'd it go?
My life. No.
Where'd it go? It'll be 10 years full time in January, but it's already past the 10 years on the show. It's just.
You know, after the first couple of thousand, you lose count. It would be fun someday if someone actually went back to the archive and figured out how many.
And one of my
part.
One of my first full time shows, though, was with you when Columbia went down.
I remember vividly.
Yeah.
Tragically. I was going to say, the hard part, of course, is to keep bringing fresh and new material, and thank God research provides that, so we don't have to, you know, make it up.
That's right.
And that's what I'm going to try to do tonight, is provide some very interesting, fresh, new things that are in the news, but are not properly put into context.
Well, there's a lot going on. Been to any movies lately, Richard?
Gosh, George, that's a softball. Robin and I went twice. And getting Robin to go twice to see a movie is, like, impossible. She is the planet's worst critic. She can find more holes in a plot,
yep.
more things wrong with the set design or the costumes or, you know, I mean, I really shudder every time I run a script by her because, as you know, over the years, I've written a couple of scripts with Paul Davids and some other folks, and we've actually had them at studios like RKO, so Robin gets to see them first. So I know we've got something when she really likes the script, because she's impossible. I mean, there are shows that I like that she looks, takes one look on TV and says, boring, and walks out of the room.
And I bet she's right. I bet it's a flunk in the ratings.
Well, it's very difficult to put an objective measure on taste. When I look at the shows, TV shows, movies, whatever, I'm looking for stuff that probably ordinary people who go, just for the fun of it, for popcorn, you know, or a date, or, you know, a good chick flick, or whatever they call them, is not going. Because I'm going to see, what does the filmmaker know that I know that he's not letting everybody else know except for those two people that know what he knows? You follow that?
I do.
So we went the other night, a couple weeks ago, to see John Carter of Mars. Now, the of Mars part is in brackets, and that's part of the story. And then the week later, we had a very, very dear friend of ours come into town, and I said, you have got to come and see John Carter of Mars.
This is based on the 1912 Burroughs classic.
The 1912 Edgar Rice Burroughs book, which actually 100 years ago last month, if last month was February, is exactly a century old and was published first as a serial installment in All Story magazine. It was one of those pulp magazines, and they call them pulps because the paper was really, really, really cheap and kind of yellow and coarse and pulpy. They weren't like the slicks, which were the smooth, very high-gloss, high-class professional magazines like Saturday Evening Post and Collier's and whatever. So we went to see this movie twice, and Robin liked it better the second time than the first time.
Huh.
At which point I said, I have got to talk to you, Mr. Norrie,
mm-hmm.
about talking about this movie and all the weird stuff orbiting around it, the controversy, the shills, the innuendos, the outright lies, there's a huge story here about this film, and that with one, you know, disclaimer, I am not on Disney's payroll. I do not get a dime tonight for talking about this film. But if I had been able over the last 10, 15 years in our various efforts with, you know, various writers and producers to get something on screen related to our work, the Mars work, the Enterprise mission investigation I've been pursuing for, you know, decades and decades, like 30-some years, this is the film I would have produced, not Andrew Stanton.
Well, when you started sending me emails about this movie, and I looked and said, this is a $250 million bust. Everything I'm reading is saying that this is a nightmare for Disney. Then you started sending me stories that were contrary to that, and I'm going, this is weird.
It's not only weird, I think it's deliberately weird. I believe, the bottom line, then we'll back up with data.
All right.
I believe Andrew Stanton has been sabotaged by the cabal, and I'll use that term, that's against anybody in this audience or the general public on this planet realizing that what Edgar Rice Burroughs was writing back in 1912 was not fiction. It may have been fictionalized, and I'm trying to track down from additional sources how that might have unfolded, and we'll get into that in a minute. But my feeling is when I saw this film and I saw the trailers and I sat there open-mouthed watching what I have seen in the actual NASA data of ancient ruins on Mars that have been ruthlessly suppressed by our space agency for the last, you know, 50 years, I could not believe how close the army of technicians and animators and, you know, film people and cinematographers and producers and gaffers and everybody that's required, you know, to make a really high-class film, I could not believe how close they had come to visualizing not as ruins but as actual 3D living structures some of the things we are seeing on the NASA data. Now, I'm hampered in that I can't provide to this audience and others yet the side-by-side comparisons because the shots in the trailers, which are the only thing that's legally out there that you can copy and do comparisons with, really don't cover some of the really cool comparisons. But when the Blu-ray DVD or, you know, comes out in a few months and we can actually buy a copy and do the screen grabs, I'm going to put out an Enterprise side-by-side versions of NASA and Russian data of Mars, of ancient cities, ancient structures that look incredibly similar to the stuff that Andrew Stanton has put in this film. And I've been asking myself now for 2 weeks, researching everything I could on every possible website, all the fan websites, the professionals, the Economist, the Disney stuff, the reviews, the movie reviews, the Hollywood crowd, everything to see what does Stanton know and when did he know it and is he actually giving a wink-wink nod-nod to what they call Easter eggs. Because I will give you one right up front, and I'm not going to spoil the film, but the one thing I'm really going to urge everybody tonight in the audience who's followed our work, for God's sake, take somebody you love, somebody you like, somebody you'd like to love, and go to the theater as soon as possible while this thing still is in the theaters and see this movie. This is the ancient pre-disaster Mars we have been trying to back-engineer from the NASA data for over 30 years, and I think it has been deliberately sabotaged from the top down when some folks somewhere finally figured out what Stanton was really up to.
Well, when Burroughs wrote this classic in 1912, what kind of an imagination did this guy have, Richard? Or what kind of intuitiveness did he have?
Or what kind of sources?
Inside information.
Yeah. I mean, look, the easiest way to get information which is secluded and sequestered and censored into the mainstream of the public is to do it through fiction. You can get away with almost anything.
That's
right.
You
do it as fiction. And then only your target audience that has other clues that it's not fiction will get the message. It'll go right over the heads of everybody else. This is so standard now for Hollywood. I mean, we could do, we actually should do some night, a kind of a review of the top 20 list of films that I can decode for you on the air and show you all the clues buried by the writers and producers in the films that nobody knows because they have not spent, you know, decades studying this stuff like a handful of us have.
That would be fun. We could bring in someone like Mark Zakri with
exactly.
you, too.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I've actually wanted to do this in Hollywood, in a major theater, with Hollywood people and just, you know, the general public and invite them in and do an evening of decoding, starting with some of the most incredible films that are filled with this kind of data, like Forbidden Planet.
Mm-hmm.
Good God, would I go through, in fact, I actually did that at Joshua Tree the night after you were there on, like, Monday night. This was several
right.
years ago. I did decode for that audience Forbidden Planet with PowerPoint and slides and detailed clips from the film. I mean, people were stunned by what no one has noticed. Now, who was one of the major players in creating Forbidden Planet?
I don't know.
Walt Disney.
Was he?
Yeah. Who almost married Walt Disney to show the American people back in the 1950s when spaceflight and rockets and going to other planets was still considered, you know, stuff on the back of cereal boxes that sane and normal, you know, sedate people didn't get involved in? Wernher von Braun. And they made two incredibly important films that are now available on YouTube. Just Google Walt Disney, Wernher von Braun, and, you know, Disney's Wonderful World of Color. And there was one classic show about going to the moon and another classic show about going to Mars. And these were, they had animations, they had science, they had interesting, you know, like Woody the Woodpecker doing little bits to explain
right.
rocket science and Newton's third law and stuff like that. I mean,
well, didn't we see these things in school? I think they wheeled them to school,
didn't
they?
Yeah. You know, my memory of that time is kind of fuzzy now, you know, after several centuries. but what's interesting is the same studio suddenly after, do you know how many studios have tried over the last 100 years to make John Carter of Mars or the Princess of Mars from Edgar Rice Burroughs?
Well, let me tell you, the trailer I saw, they did a great job. And just for people who don't know who John Carter is, or
yeah.
the Burroughs classic, he basically was teleported to Mars, right?
He went into a cave in Arizona and mysteriously wakes up on Mars. Well, what Stanton has done in the film is actually bring in another layer from the second book. He optioned the first three books in the series, Princess of Mars, Gods of Mars, and Warlord of Mars. And he's kind of picked and chosen elements from the second book to put into the first movie, so you have a better understanding of what Burroughs are trying to say. Bottom line, I can prove tonight, for most people who followed our work, I can prove that Burroughs just didn't make this stuff up. And I'll hit you right between the eyes with the key piece of data. And it's not something I've found out recently. I have known this for well on 20 years. And you know the old Orson Welles thing, make no wine before it's time.
That's right.
There are times when data is relevant, when you can put it out there and people will take a listen or take a look. And there are other times when they won't. So you can't be premature. Every piece of information has to fit into its appropriate context in terms of time. Well, now with this film and the huge controversy over why did Disney shoot it in the head and try to bury it before it even came out on the screen, it's time to reveal that Edgar Rice Burroughs, in my estimation, was not writing fiction. He was fictionalizing fact. And he, in fact, is trying to tell us, between the lines, a semi-truth. In other words, if you read the book, starting with Princess of Mars, which was actually put into book form in 1917 after the serialization of the stories in 1912. By the way, you know that's exactly 100 years from the sinking of the Titanic?
Yeah, that's
bizarre. Which is coming up. In the next
it's coming up. It's coming up. Well, was this movie or not, though, a financial bust?
It's only made, what, $300 million gross globally? How many failures? I mean, look, you're homeless on the street. You're a bum on the street. And someone picks you up and says, hey, I'm going to give you a job in a movie, but it's only going to make $300 million, so you might not want to take it. This is propaganda. This is a deliberate, concerted effort to make everybody who's not seen it think it's a flop, because who wants to be associated, even as a viewer, with a flop if it's a terrible movie and it's losing money and it's the biggest bomb in history? All those code words are to get you to not go to the theater.
That's true.
And I'm telling you, folks, if you go, 99% of you who have followed our work are going to come out absolutely with your head swimming, amazed that someone has finally put what we have been looking at in reality, in science, for 30 years on the widescreen in 3D with some amazing CGI that is so seamless that you lose track of the fact that the Tharks are not real beings, real conscious entities, real people. And you will not think of them as CGI creatures. You'll think of them as people. It's that good. And the pacing and the timing and the role Stanton has given to Deja Theris, who is the princess of Mars, who is actually the heroine, who holds her own with Carter, and who is responsible for trying to use the MacGuffin of the whole movie, which Burroughs writes very scantily about, and Stanton has fleshed out, you know, that subject with, I think, additional material, and that raises the question, who is Stanton, and what is he really trying to tell us? From what sources did he have in addition to Burroughs? And I'll get back to why I know Burroughs is telling us truth and not fiction in a minute. But Deja Theris is the regent of science. She's the daughter of the king of helium, because Mars at this point has devolved into a series of city-states like Greece, who are at war with each other. And there's two main cities that are at war, which is the central spine of the film, the conflict between these two city-states that Carter is asked to intercede with. And initially, he doesn't want to have a damn thing to do with it, because the story arc of John Carter and the evolution of his life from being totally despairing and despondent on Earth to having to retrieve the humanity and hero-ness in himself in this exotic alien situation is very nice storytelling. And it really does not disappoint. And again, Robin is the acid critic. If she liked the love story, if she liked the science, if she liked the vistas, you know, everybody who sees this has at least got to like it as much as I did.
You loved it, didn't you?
I love it. Yeah. I'm thinking Stanton is a genius, or he has data. And when I can get the DVD, the Blu-ray, or whatever it is, and actually put side-by-side comparisons of some of these things on the screen, so you can see the ancient data of abandoned ruined cities in the NASA data, and what his art department and his animatronics people and his, you know, filmmakers did in terms of making it come to life as a place where people really lived, which, of course, brings us to is Barsoom, which is the name of Mars in the Burroughs novel. Is Barsoom Mars that we know, the Barsoom that NASA has given us, or is it actually Mars at an earlier time? And there's a huge clue in the film. I'm not going to give it away. People can come to my Facebook page, and we'll have wonderful conversations after you see it. Just go to Facebook.com and type in my name, and you'll find either my fan or friends page. We will have conversations about the clues that, in fact, the technology that is used to transport John Carter from Earth to Mars is not only a spatial transporter, which is really coolly exhibited in the film, but it's also a temporal transporter. In other words, the Mars/Barsoom that Carter is transported to is not contemporary Mars. It's of an earlier time, and there's a huge clue in a film where Stanton pays painstaking, excruciating detail to every piece of scenery, every costume, every bit of science, every ship, every airship, every battle. This is such a glaring omission or error, unless you're looking at time travel, that I think it's another one of those little Easter eggs that he snuck in, and he pretends he didn't have time when in these interviews I've been watching to do any of this.
Well, we're going to find out more about what did Burroughs know and also get into the space program next with Richard C. Hoagland. And our guest tonight, Richard C. Hoagland, we're talking about all things space. We're going to come back to the Burroughs classic in the film John Carter later on tonight as we get into that with Richard. But let's get went from him the status of the current U.S. space program, what's happening there. We'll get right into that when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you along with Richard Hoagland. Richard, what have you been up to lately? I know we are constantly communicating, IMing and emailing back and forth, but any traveling? What have you been doing?
To do two interesting expeditions. One is just a short ways away. There's an eclipse coming, an annular eclipse of the sun in 2012, one of two that happened this year. And as fate would happen, it actually is coming right to me here in Albuquerque, so I don't have to move very far from one end of the office to the other. And I'm going to be able to do some extraordinary actual torsion field measurements using our Accutron technology that I have trekked all over the world with Robin, from Mexico, pyramids there, to Guatemala, to Cal, the pyramids there, to England and the ancient monuments there. And I'm going to be able to do our first actual solar eclipse measurements, harking back to the Nobel laureate Maurice Allais, who discovered in 1954, when a total eclipse passed over his laboratory about 100 feet underground, he didn't even know it was going on. He's down there measuring pendulums, a variation of the Foucault pendulum. And suddenly, during the height of the eclipse, his pendulum goes crazy. It starts swinging backward and doing things that no self-respecting pendulum ever has done in the known history of science. And then he was able to repeat the observation, because science is repetition. You know, can you do it again?
Yeah.
With another eclipse in, I think, 1959. And the same thing happened. And since then, there have been scattered efforts to duplicate these measurements. There was a big effort spearheaded by NASA itself and a guy at the Marshall Space Flight Center, which is in the southern tier of the country down in Alabama, to do a very thorough and comprehensive and systematic set of measurements on the eclipse track in 1999, where the August eclipse crossed Paris and Europe in just about the same geometry as the one in 54 when Allais first made this, you know, serendipitous discovery. And then something really bizarre happened, George. The chief NASA scientist who had funneled all this data into Marshall as part of this global united scientific effort to verify Allais, he disappeared from NASA and took all the data with him.
Where'd he go?
We don't know. He's never published it. No one can find him. That's like he just ceased to exist.
Who's John Galt?
I mean, this, of course, adds the level of conspiracy because it gets back to the theme of the Carter film. The big thing in the Carter film, which is the MacGuffin, which is the Hitchcock term for the big thing you're trying to find in a really cool movie, is the physics. The physics, the torsion field physics, which is called in the film the secret of the ninth ray, and I'll get into where that came from in a moment. It looks like, from what I saw in the film, remember, I've seen it twice now, it looks like the physics in the John Carter film, the physics which is big enough to transform and save Barsoom, to replenish the oceans, to make the deserts bloom, to do stunning magical things, which Deidre Thoris, as the chief regent of science of the city of Helium, has back-engineered from the bits and scraps left around the planet from what came before, is the same physics which the bad guys in the film, who are called the Therns, and they're really cool bad guys. Wait till you get there. you got to go see this movie, George, so we can have a real discussion.
Well, I was going to until I saw it was panned.
Well, then you got time to see it on the big screen. You got to see it big screen, IMAX is best, 3D IMAX, the whole nine yards. Immerse yourself in what Mars that Hoagland's been yakking about for decades really looks like when you add in the missing players.
I got suckered into the bust scenario.
You can't read reviews. Read the citizen reviews. Read the viewer reviews. Read the countless blogs and blog sites that have people actually went and saw it. And 90 to 1, they're raving about it. And they're going back 3, 4, 5, 6 times. But there's not enough of them because most people bought the party line, the propaganda, go see the film. Because someone is trying to conceal the physics that we are going to measure here in Albuquerque on the afternoon of May 20th, when the eclipse comes right to the doorstep of Enterprise. I mean, the odds of a total eclipse or an annular eclipse going at, around over any particular place on Earth is only once in every 300 years. So that's pretty cool, but it, I don't have to go to it. It's going to come to me. And I've got all these other measurements. Well, what we're measuring is a variation of what the Nobel laureate, Maurice Allais, measured back in 1954, which is when the planets align, or when, in this case, the sun and the moon align, the physics goes nuts. Inertia and gravity and all the things that are supposedly neatly explained in the textbooks and that, you know, allow NASA to send rocket ships all over the solar system, the actual equations are different than are publicly published. This has been an effort, and Joseph Farrell can, you know, kind of, you know, attest to the veracity of this if you get him on the show again. There has been a systematic effort, we have now tracked, both of us and some others as well, for hundreds of years to develop what's called a two-track science. The real science buried deeply inside and suppressed from the general community.
That we don't see.
And we don't see. One which is based a stunning, you know, in an Arthur Clarke term, any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic kind of technology that's using this science, this physics, to make amazing things happen. That's the storyline of John Carter of Mars, the regent of science under her father, the Jeddak, which is kind of slash for king of one of these city-states, Helium, has figured out, has back-engineered this secret suppressed science, which the Therns are using to systematically destroy Mars. And she says in one part of the film, and John Carter, Earth is next. I mean, Stanton is giving away all the secrets in this film, and that's why, in my political analysis, there has been this incredible, deliberate, systematic, concerted effort to keep as many people from going to see this film as possible, because it's right up there on the big screen. Remember my dear friend Gene Roddenberry, and one of the last things he ever said to me when I showed him the first pictures of Cydonia? Remember that great line? He looked at me and he said, but Dick, if this was real, it would be on television. Meaning it would be in media, it would be on the big screen.
It would be big stuff.
And that's what Stanton has done. And I have now looked at every interview from him going all the way back to WALL-E and back to Finding Nemo and back to his role in Toy Story. Disney didn't put any of this stuff in the trailers. That, look, films rise or fall on directors, right? When you say Spielberg, yes. If you know films by Spielberg, you almost don't have to know what it's about. You'll go see it, right?
That's right.
We are driven by the star system. You know, Stanton had incredible storytelling credits and a technical group to absolutely, you know, kill for. And he could not have produced, if you knew it was Stanton who had done this, a bad movie. Maybe not a super great movie, but certainly not a bad movie, given the storyteller he is. He's won 2 Oscars, for God's sake. You don't do that by making bad movies. But nowhere in the Disney marketing did they ever hint that Andrew Stanton was the same guy who had brought you Toy Story and WALL-E and Nemo. Nothing. Zip. Nada. That's how you keep people from the theaters who are the middle of the curve, who are not nerds like you and me.
And they were all classics. Well, we're going to come back to that, but I want to get your take now on just where we are, Richard, with our space program, because I'm hearing all kinds of strange stories.
Well, we are poised on the edge of either astonishingly amazing things or on the edge of catastrophe. And I can't tell tonight which. So I will lay out both scenarios. Did you happen to read Bob Zubrin's op-ed piece I sent you?
Yes, I sure did.
I mean, he has nailed it from the conventional perspective. My job at Enterprise and here on Coast is to
bring... Exactly.
So I'm going to give you the two... You know, why don't you summarize what Zubrin says, then I'll tell you what my take might
be. Well, Zubrin basically, and I'm going to do it in a two-line paragraph, says we're butchering the space program, and we should be developing a program to go to Mars. And from there, take over.
Yep, that's it. In the FY 2013 budget, fiscal year 13 NASA budget, that the Obama administration has submitted formally to the Congress, the Mars missions, all the unmanned Mars missions, which have been going every 2 years, because in terms of celestial mechanics, you can send a robot spacecraft to Mars every two years.
Right. That's we've had some great missions.
Oh, we've had all kinds of missions. We've had the rover missions. We've had the orbiter missions. We've had Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, which has a super telescope orbiting that can take photographs of things the size of my desk from, you know, 100, 200 miles up. We've had stunning missions concurrently building on the one that came before. There is a major robotic mission en route now, which will arrive literally in weeks, which is a car-sized, a VW car-sized nuclear-powered rover called Curiosity, which is going to be lowered down through the atmosphere after re-entry, or after entry, technically speaking, on something called a sky crane, which is right out of the most wild dreams of Edgar Rice Burroughs you can imagine.
Yeah, this is the first time this is going to be used, right?
First time ever. And after that, the NASA budget, as submitted by Obama, goes zero for Mars. Nothing. We have canceled funding with the Europeans, something called ExoMars, in 2016 and 2018. There's no sample return missions. There's no more orbiters, no more reconnaissance, no more nothing going to Europa like we thought in some of the early budget projections. And Zubrin is rightfully tearing out his hair, as only he can do in the pages of the Washington Times.
He's the best at that.
And he's got some really elegant prose in his piece. So, you know, people should go to the Washington Times and simply, you know, Google Zubrin, Obama shoots down Mars exploration, because he can't figure out, and there have been resignations at NASA headquarters. Ed Weiler, who has shepherded so much of this amazing science, Hubble and the rovers, you know, Sojourner and Opportunity through NASA, and then there, you know, for the tragedy of the Hubble mirror not working, and then the fix where they brought it back to life and it's done stunning, amazing things and given us views of distant places that we've never seen before in 3D color, and the rover missions that have learned that Mars was chock full of water. In other words, all the science that NASA has learned has built up to the fact that the science of the real Mars is the science of Burroughs current.
Is this, though, the public perception of Mars that's been canceled?
No, these are real missions.
I know, but these are the public missions.
Well, yeah.
What about the ones that we don't hear about?
We have no idea what the black missions, the secret space program, is doing. But let's just stay with the NASA mission.
All right.
Zubrin and the science community are tearing their hair out, as I said a moment ago, because to them this seems like the end. This is it.
Yes.
The Hoagland Enterprise perspective is a little bit different. This is 2012. This is the year when the apocalypse is supposed to happen. Now, the apocalypse is not the end of the world. The apocalypse is insight, revelation, uplifting of mankind, the revealing of secrets, the opening of doorways to new consciousness, right? That's the literal meaning of the Latin term.
Or portals.
A portal to an unusual consciousness-raising set of experiences and information. What if the Obama folks know, based on where they have targeted this Curiosity nuclear-powered car-sized rover to land, which we discussed somewhat extensively in the last full show I did a few months ago, what if they know that in the next 12 months, let's say, between 2012 and 2013, there are going to be stunning revelations that are going to finally bring to light the Mars that I've been researching, the Mars Edgar Rice Burroughs was writing about from some unknown source 100 years ago, the Mars laid out in this incredibly interesting film, hint, hint, people got to go see, what if that suddenly hits the mainstream, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, NBC, CBS, ABC, Fox, CNN, etc., and suddenly either the presence of current microbial life or the presence of past intelligent artifacts from past intelligent life is suddenly made known, suddenly brought out of the closet because of this rover and where it's going and what it's got on board in terms of science to be able to carry out. And you would then know that every NASA plan, every funding of every unmanned mission is going to get thrown in the scrap heap instantly anyway, because at that point, suddenly there will be an overwhelming demand planet-wide to send human beings to Mars. Robert, are you listening?
So you think the plan is cancel the robotics, let's go there physically.
Exactly, because no one's going to want robots to go, they're going to want people. Now, again, you just said something important. You said you think. No, this is a scenario. This is a projection of another possibility that takes the same data and fits it into a different explanation. Now, I have additional information to support this scenario, such as the White House this past Christmas released a Christmas card. And I spent a lot of time on my Facebook page with a lot of my 40,000 fans and friends having fun decoding what was in the card.
What was in the card?
Basically, a tip-off that Curiosity is going to reveal ancient life on Mars.
What were the clues?
Well, they're visual.
Ah.
You have to go to either Enterprise or my Facebook page to go back and scroll back like months back to before Christmas when the Christmas card came out, which was, I think, December 17th. So if there's a way to search in Facebook for that conversation, it was a bulletin I posted, an editorial, and then we had days and days and days of discussion that went on for hundreds, if not thousands, of you know, exchanges, entries. But I will do that again as we get closer to Curiosity getting to Mars, and I'll do it on Enterprise. We've now solved almost, we think, all of the software problems that have kept me from posting an Enterprise for at least a couple of years, and we will begin posting new stuff on Enterprise, which is the proper place to post lengthy things that need buttressing and substantiation and documentation, and then we can all have fun talking about it over at Facebook. The point is, there are clues. Again, like the Easter eggs that Stanton has buried in this film, John Carter. I mean, what person, what company, what major marketing behemoth in their right mind, when they've got a film based on a 100-year-old property where most of the people who ever read it are probably dead in the original, and a whole new generation has been introduced to it through either comic books or hand-me-down books or hearing about it maybe in a English writing course in school or something, who would possibly take Of Mars out of the title so that your standalone title is just John Carter? Who
That's
the hell is John
point.
Carter?
And by the way, Curiosity lands August 6th.
Yep. John Carter was a player, was an actor, was a person in ER. Did you know that?
No.
And that John Carter was named after the John Carter in the Edgar Rice Burroughs books in the story arc of the ER, you know, television show. So obviously a lot of people, when they saw John Carter in the trailers, what is this guy from ER doing on, where is he?
He's
on
Mars.
How do you conceal science fiction by not revealing that it's going to Mars? It made no sense. It was dumb, unless it was dumb as a fox, because it was designed to keep the audience to a minimum, minimum, minimum. Well, if we're reading the Easter eggs that the Obama White House put into this Christmas card correctly, and there is one huge Easter egg, which if people go and find the card and then compare it to the logo of the Curiosity NASA mission, side by side, compare them, you'll see what Obama's trying to say in this scenario.
Why did they do it in code, Richard? Hey. We're going to come back. Hold on for a second. We're going to come back in a moment. We'll talk more about that on Coast to Coast AM. And, of course, our special guest tonight is Richard C. Hoagland. As we talk about all things space, he says there's a code out there, a message. Let's find out, and I'm dying to find out how he thinks that Edgar Rice Burroughs, back in the early 1900s, had inside information about Mars. Let's get Richard's thoughts on that, too, when we come right back. And welcome back. Richard C. Hoagland is with us. Richard, tell us about this code. Why do you think they're trying to send us messages? Why don't they just be direct?
Well, that's, of course, the $64 question. You know, it's the idiom of the 20th, 21st century that all things are known to all people democratically. But if you have any historical sense, if you know about secret societies and mystery schools and groups like the Freemasons or the Rosicrucians or all kinds of other sects, including people like the Mormons, who are kind of in the news these days,
mm-hmm.
you know that the most important truths of these religions, cults, you know, messianic groups, secret societies, mystery schools, whatever, are never given in plain language because they're not intended for most people. They're intended for a restricted audience, a limited viewing, a special group, the insiders, the initiated, the folks who have a need to know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now, you can ask, and obviously it's a key question I've been looking at for the last 3.5 years vis-a-vis the Obama administration, what is a democratically elected president, 44th president of the United States, doing communicating to someone or someones in this kind of code? And this is not the first time. I have produced some DVDs, which are available through the Enterprise website, going back years since his election, showing that this is not a new thing with the Obama administration. It's not a new thing with the previous Bush administration. It wasn't a new thing with the previous Clinton administration. In fact, the presidency of itself, the U.S. presidency of the institution that we think of as the leadership of this republic called the United States of America, in fact, has been dealing for decades after decades in this kind of high-level code. And some of the most prominent holders of that office have been prominent members, public members, of some of these secret societies, such as the Masons. FDR was a 32nd-degree Mason,
yep.
Succeeded by Harry S. Truman. I've got a photograph of Truman dressed up in all his Masonic regalia as a 33rd-degree master. So for most people, except, of course, the Coast audience, this will come as a shock. This audience should not be shocked. Now, if 2012 means anything in terms of all the people you've had on the show going back at least 10 years, then wouldn't you think that high-level important information between these groups, including the head of the country itself, of which we are a part, would be communicating important things in a code that not everyone is meant to share in yet? That's what we seem to be seeing. And when you put these photographs side by side, the Curiosity NASA logo, which has a distinctly archaic, almost Edgar Rice Burroughs feel to it, which you'll see when you do a search on the web and bring it up, side by side with this Obama Christmas card of this past year, a few months ago, December 17th, 2011, you will see an incredibly common symbol in both images, and symbols are the language of secret codes.
And so this code is?
Well, to me,
life on Mars?
What it's saying is, watch the Curiosity mission. Something big is going to happen. And it doesn't take a rocket scientist, really, to figure out that the big thing that Curiosity is going to find, ergo its name, is that we are not alone. Now, that discovery, that revelation, can range the gamut from microbes, which for most people, except this audience, of course, would be really a big deal. But the really big deal for you and me and this audience would be if Curiosity discovers with its cameras and other incredibly sophisticated sensors. I mean, the thing, for God's sake, has a laser on it that can shoot and develop a spectral fingerprint of objects 100 feet away. It's got a ray gun on Mars.
Well, if there's a code about life, then they already know there is life.
Well, of course they do. You know how they do? A few years ago, remember the story that you and I and Paula Harris covered, which including having her kind of chase around on a moped Dr. Formosino from the European Space Agency at a conference on a little island off Italy.
Mm-hmm.
And it was all about the discovery of ammonia and methane on Mars.
That's right.
There have been studies, telescopic studies, and spacecraft studies from the Europeans, from ESA, from the European Space Agency, the Mars Express mission, of which Formosino was one of the principal investigators, one of the key instruments, which have now published in open scientific conferences the stunning discovery repeated over several years now. This started in the early 2000s, like 2002, 2003. It's now no controversial subject at all that for some reason Mars seasonally is emitting methane from somewhere into its atmosphere in quantities that have got to come either from rotting vegetation
or volcanoes, right?
Or from current living plant life. Because methane is a molecule that is so fragile that it is destroyed by sunlight in only a few hundred years.
What about active volcanoes, Richard?
There are no active volcanoes.
None.
Okay. On Mars. None. Zero. Zip. Nada. We know that from the geology scans. All this flotilla of spacecraft that Zubrin carefully recounts in his op-ed, in which he's now bemoaning the fact that they will eventually all drop dead and go away with no replacements, we know that Mars does not have any volcanic active, you know, fissures, calderas, lava fields, et cetera, et cetera.
Isn't that strange that it doesn't?
Not really, because Mars is smaller than Earth and its geology ended. Remember, the whole Barsoomian Lowell Mars image was a dying planet.
Yes, it is
dying planet geologically, as well as all the things geology makes possible, which includes life. So we've had from places like Catholic University and a very stellar NASA scientist at the Goddard Space Flight Center, my old alma mater at NASA when I was there, independent studies confirming with the best telescopes on Earth, backed up by Formosino and the best instrumentation orbiting Mars, that Mars is emitting these gases, which are indicative of life. I mean, cows and a lot of other creatures on this planet belch out methane as part of their effluvia, right? You can almost tell that there's life on Mars from the flatulence. And that's one of the models. Well, Curiosity carries, finally, after decades, it carries an instrument, a mass spectrometer, which can actually separate different isotopes of carbon, carbon-12, carbon-13, carbon-14, and life on Earth predominantly incorporates carbon-12, and we assume that life on other planets will include carbon-12, which means if the methane is tagged with carbon-13, then we know it's natural. If it's carbon-12, it's potentially biological. And this August, starting this August, as soon as that thing lands and opens up its sensors from day one, it will be sampling and sniffing the atmosphere. So a big reveal could be, oh, guess what? Mars appears to have some kind of life that's belching mm-hmm. out methane.
Exactly.
Now, it could be microbes, and most of the Coast audience is not going to get very excited by microbes. But remember, this audience, George, is not your normal slice of Americana. We know too much.
We're ahead of the curve.
Fooled too much. We've heard too much. We've seen too much. We've experienced too much. But for ordinary Americans and the editorial writers of the New York Times and the Washington Post and the networks, it will be a huge, big, blankety-blank deal if Curiosity finds microbes on Mars.
It'll be a huge story.
Oh,
it'll lead everywhere.
Remember, we're going from zero life to any kind of life is almost infinity. Because at the moment, we have one example of life in the whole universe, which is here. And if we get another example, as Carl Sagan used to say over and over again, independently involved on Mars, it means, Mr. Spock, the galaxy is teeming with life. Well, you put that together with the results of the unmanned robotic Kepler mission, which you discussed with one of the scientists the other night,
mm-hmm.
and you now know that they're extrapolating from the Kepler results that there could be billions, emphasize, billions with a B, habitable planets in the Milky Way galaxy alone. And if Curiosity were to find evidence of real life, even if it's a microbe, right next door, currently living, breathing and multiplying and giving out little puffs of methane seasonally, everything changes and we're off to the races in all the ways that Neil deGrasse Tyson says are desperately needed now to give a boost to the economy in the same way that John Kennedy's vision of a vigorous space program in the 1960s gave us the 21st century and everything that we think that we certainly take for granted, including all the iPads and iPods and everything around your office right there at the moment. And that all came from going to the moon and going to Mars and sending probes around the solar system. We're not doing that anymore. As Zubrin's editorial lays out, that has petered out to where now we're down to one final mission with nothing else on the boards. Either that's a really bad thing, meaning the end is almost here, or it portends a total phase change where everything NASA's projecting it would do with robots, it will suddenly have the dollars from Congress to do with men and women.
If you were heading up NASA, and I just announced it last night, as a matter of fact, on the show, that if I was running the show, you'd be in charge of NASA. You'd be the greatest promoter and thinker that they could have. If you were running NASA, would you plan it this way? A little leak about microbes on Mars, and then bang, come in with an announcement, we're going to Mars with men?
Yep. And the reason is the history that we had during Sputnik. DeGrasse Tyson, in his book, Space Chronicles, talks about how the whole shock of Sputnik that catapulted us into the solar system big time and got all these probes going every place and all this incredible invention and patents and, you know, the basic incorporation of the 21st century in terms of technology and science, including going to and from the moon, all came about because we were in a race and a competition with the Russians, and suddenly we were outdone by them. We had a cultural psychic shock to our psyche. The Russians made it into orbit with Sputnik first. And that catapulted Americans, who hate to be second in anything until they get blasé and lazy and basically self-indulgent, and they don't remember that to stay number one, you got to stay number one. You got to keep doing something that makes you number one. You can't rest on your laurels. That's what we're doing now. We're resting on our laurels. People look around, they wonder why the economy is going to hell in a handbasket. It's because we're not inventing the future and creating the technologies and science at which products and monies and fortunes and the well-being of millions of people are made, as they were back in the 60s and 70s from the shock of the 50s when Sputnik suddenly appeared in our skies.
Well, these aren't stupid people, Richard. They're very calculated.
No, they're very smart. You don't get to be president of the United States by being stupid. And I've been impressed by Obama being smart. The whole teleprompter thing is such a gaffe. It's such a canard. It's such a distraction. You know, the naysayers will say he can't, you know, frame one coherent sentence if he doesn't have a teleprompter. That's a deliberate, the people are being led down that path to underestimate. Remember, you can make big changes in history if your opposition underestimates you. So the idea is to keep them underestimating you, like John Kennedy did before he suddenly announced and won as the youngest guy ever to run and win the presidency, and he was a Roman Catholic to boot. And he made it stick, and he became the president that we all remember. The point I'm making is, trying to make, is that if I was doing the masterminding, I would set up the surprise, the shock, so that you could then move through Congress rapidly in a competitive environment where the old Russia appears to be suddenly rising again like some kind of a antithesis, some kind of a competitor.
Albatross.
What was it Romney said the other day? Our worst geopolitical enemy on the planet? Well, not really. But if it's politics and you want people to buy that, a lot of people will, won't they? Like they did before. And then you don't want them to get to Mars before you do to claim the prizes of what? If we slide down the spectrum from just microbes to where Curiosity discovers more interesting things, like are in this film, John Carter, then all bets are off. You will see a Sputnik moment, a game changer, the likes of which only old guys like you and me have lived through and remember. And you will be off to the races.
When will the race start? If this thing lands in August of this year, how long will it take before they get some testing and some confirmation done?
Well, it's like those little babies that are so cute and adorable, born to the Tharks in John Carter. They're born out of eggs, ready to go. This thing, when it lands, is ready to go. So we could have actual atmospheric data on the composition of the methane within days, weeks. Now, obviously, what they're going to do is they're going to take data, and be really, 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 really sure before they announce anything. But by Christmas of 2012, George, not only could we have atmospheric data supporting either the presence of current microbes or decaying vegetation from a past epoch when life was teeming on Mars and killed and buried in the catastrophe, just like, you know, the current myth about oil and dinosaurs, or we could have close-up photographs of artifacts seen on those stunning cameras, those incredible high-resolution color cameras, because where they're landing, George, as I said on the last show, which is in this incredible structure in the middle of a place called Gale Crater. From our analysis, the damn thing looks like a 90-mile-wide tetrahedral arcology, an ancient living structure on Mars, a city-state self-contained in ruins that looks eerily like the stuff that's portrayed in Andrew Stanton's film, John Carter.
Now, I've got to ask you this. Did Burroughs, when he wrote his book back in the early 1900s, actually pinpoint Cydonia on Mars as an ancient capital city?
You've got it.
How did he pick that?
The ancient capital city of Mars in his Barstoom, you know, anthologies, all 11 books, was a place called Horz, H-O-R-Z, located in the northern hemisphere on the edges of a great dried-up ancient ocean. The sea bottoms, the dead sea bottoms of Barstoom is as he described them. And it was at 0 degrees longitude, which, of course, is where Cydonia is if the D&M pyramid was 0 degrees longitude in an ancient Martian system, and 42 degrees north, which is the longitude and latitude of Cydonia on Mars now. How did he know? How could he possibly have known? No telescope on the planet in, 1912 or 1911, when he actually started writing this stuff, existed which could possibly have seen anything smaller than several tens of miles across. The canals were seen by Percival Lowell and ensuing telescopes to be about 30 miles across because of the shimmering of the atmosphere and the quality of the optics and the problems of glare and scattering and just technology at that time. There's no way that Burroughs or any scientist on Earth could have seen what's at Cydonia. We only knew that when we got there with spacecraft and looked down with cameras from a couple of hundred miles up.
More to come with Richard C. on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast AM. Richard C. Hoagland, our guest next hour. We'll flip the switch, open up the phone lines. But when we come back, more to talk with him about as we go to Mars on Coast to Coast AM. Richard, back to Edgar Rice Burroughs again. If he had inside information in the early 1900s, how far back did we know things?
Well, I think it's going back hundreds, if not thousands of years. Look, you cannot have a major high-tech advanced super civilization in this solar system with a huge catastrophe on the one planet, Mars, forcing refugees to come to the other planet, Earth, and not have some kind of cultural memory. Probably preserved, at least that's our model, which I'm going to lay out in great detail in a book that I'm now finally beginning to work on, which is going to be called The Heritage of Mars, Remembering Forever.
Okay, cool.
Remember, my first book on Mars was called The Monuments of Mars, City on the Edge of Forever.
That's right.
Now we finally know enough, particularly with this film, John Carter, to be able to put the end cap on this saga that I've been pursuing scientifically as best we could for the last 30 years. So the next book, which I'm beginning in the process of actually putting outlines together and showing it to publishers, I've got a couple in mind that I've already talked to this about, is going to be called The Heritage of Mars, Remembering Forever, because that's what I think we're dealing with. This is a huge cultural memory. And what's really amazing in the film is that you have two groups, two almost warring camps of Martians who are human, as apart from the Tharks, who are not human. And then the question, of course, you've got to ask is, how did those human-looking folks get to Mars? Were they born there? That's not what evolutionary biology says, et cetera. So it opens up all kinds of questions as to why are there different groups of humans, you know, the white guys, the red guys, the yellow guys, the black guys, who are human, but on Mars. Then you have this subgroup called the Therns, who in the movie, as apart from Burroughs' book, turn out to be the real, almost puppet masters, although they themselves are controlled by an unseen force that we never see in the movie, but you know, Stanton carefully alludes to. And it's clearly communicated in the film that not only are they designing the death of Mars, of Barsoom, by deliberate design, they are also looking at Earth, and they have been to Earth. There's one scene in particular where one of these godlike Therns, who have this amazing technology, which is totally hyperdimensional and torsion field physics, if it's, you know, anything, and can control beings and the surrounding events with, you know, wristbands and rays and all that. And by the way, the reason it's called ninth ray technology is because back when Burroughs was writing all this in the early teens of the 20th century, the spectrum, the electromagnetic spectrum, was composed of seven rays, right?
That's right.
Infrared, red, yellow, red, orange, yellow, green, blue, and violet.
Mm-hmm.
He posited, based on God knows what, that on the other end of the spectrum, beyond the violet, beyond the ultraviolet, there were an eighth and a ninth ray, which could be the basis of this kind of super physics, super technology. So Deirdre Tharis in the film talks about her cracking the code of the ninth ray, and she actually produces in one of the scenes a working prototype device, which is then sabotaged by the bad guys. The point is that this technology, this physics, is enunciated in the film as either being able to do super incredibly positive things, save and transform a whole planet and return it to its pristine condition, or destroy it. And the same guys who control it, who are suppressing it on Mars, and that's the arc of the story, obviously, in the projections, also have a great hand, if not the hand, in suppressing it here on Earth. You, of course, know a good friend of mine, Jay Widener, right?
Yes.
Sure. Filmmaker?
Yep.
Well, Jay Widener and I have been discussing for years this group of beings, these guys who basically are meddling in our affairs and keeping us down on the farm, except we didn't call them Therns. They're called, in actually other literature, the Archons.
Mm-hmm.
Even Gene Roddenberry did a Star Trek about the Archons.
That's right.
Well, if you know, it would be fun to call up Jay and just get what he thinks about this film. He's a filmmaker.
He
knows all the stuff we've been talking about. Why don't you have Tom put in a call to him and see if he'll give us 5 or 10 minutes on his thoughts? Because I don't want people to think that I'm just by myself in this. I want you all to go out and see this movie. If enough of us go out and see this movie, not once, but twice, maybe three times, and it's worth it, they will make the sequel. Stanton already has written part two and part three, in which there is stunningly additional information he is set to reveal if the numbers prove to the bottom line guys he can make a decent film that will have a decent audience. So that's why
they've got a ways to go.
Satisfaction. We need to see the film.
They've got a ways to go to get that thing up.
This audience has done amazing things before, George.
I think
we could do something here.
But you need about 50 million people to go see.
Well, remember, every coastie has two friends, and they have two friends, and they have two friends. I'm serious. That's how Facebook works. Do you realize for the 40,000 friends I have on Facebook, fans and friends, they give me the stats that potentially I can talk to 8 to 9 million people? How many people, you know, that game of Kevin Bacon, how many people does everybody in this Coast audience know who could go to the movies and make this a hit and have a hell of a good time in the process?
Well, that's a good point, too.
There are no limits to what we can do if we understand it's important to do it, because the Easter eggs are in this film.
When I talked to you and the late Tom Van Flandern years ago, we talked about Mars. I asked you guys a specific question. What did Mars look like at one time? And I think you told me, Richard, I'm pretty sure it was you, it was a small Earth-like planet. Remember that?
Yes, of course.
What happened to it? Was it too small? Is that what happened to it?
Well, that's the conventional science, that the atmosphere just dribbled away, that the core cooled down, et cetera, et cetera. I frankly think it's more interesting. In Burroughs' books, he talks about the great cataclysm. He never describes what it is. But Joseph Farrell and Tom Van Flandern and I and some others have looked at the data, and our consensus now, which I will flesh out in The Heritage of Mars, is that Mars suffered a huge, humongous cosmic war. And it is the technology the Therns in the film are keeping secret and only using for destruction, which in fact was the reason Mars was killed.
Now, what do you mean by cosmic war?
Well, this solar system...
A battle?
Of course. This solar system used to be inhabited by a Type 2 civilization on the Kardashev scale. Remember how Michio Kaku keeps talking about Type 1, Type 2, Type 3?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, well, he's borrowing that from a brilliant Soviet astrophysicist, Kardashev, who was a protege, a grad student, of another brilliant astrophysicist named Shlovsky, I.S. Shlovsky, who Carl Sagan in 1966 did a book with called Intelligent Life in the Universe. And it was in that book that Shlovsky proposed that the two moons of Mars were not natural, but they were artificial and launched by an ancient Martian race based on his astrophysical science of the 1950s, or at least that's what everybody assumes. Maybe Shlovsky and Kardashev, as his grad student, understood from documents they had access to. See where I'm going, George? You can't take anything anymore at face value. Everything has to be asked in triplicate, in quadruplicate. You have to look for layers and codes and secret messaging, because history is not what we see on CNN. History is between the lines by groups that have agendas that are never to see the light of day, and that's, again, the core of this film. He has spilled the beans in John Carter, and that's hit the nail on the head, is why I think Disney, when they figured out what he was up to, have tried every way possible to kill this film before too many people see it and get the message.
Why would they want to kill it and commit suicide?
Because it's not suicide. If you look at The Economist and the numbers, when they announced in the first few days, remember right after the premiere, that they were going to take a $200 million write-down, their stock didn't even hiccup. You know why? Because movie making for the Disney Corporation is a tiny percentage, 1 or 2% of their mega billion-dollar empire, which is mostly based on, the theme parks and merchandising and all kinds of other things having nothing to do with film.
Well,
we will find out. They won't suffer at all. In fact, their stock 3 days later went up.
If they announce sometime in August or September or October that Curiosity has discovered that there's microbial life on Mars, I'll have to give you another cigar.
Well, it could happen. Again, the handwriting secretly is on the... Oh, by the way.
Well, they can't keep sending these robotic missions without coming back with some great stuff.
Well, eventually, that's why I looked at this when Obama said enough is enough. The same way when he basically countermanded Bush's idea of going back to Mars with, Apollo and steroids. The only reason, the moon, not Mars. The only reason to go back to the moon is to go back to stay. Because only if you stay and have bases and can send out sorties and begin to investigate the artificial stuff that's on the moon will we make the advances that will do the stunning things for the economy and civilization that have to be done. But that is not going to be developed in sortie missions, spending billions of dollars to go once every year or 2 years, which is what the Bush plan had been.
Right. I think the moon is loaded.
Are you aware that as part of the 2011 budget agreement with the Congress, a replacement for the shuttle called the SLS, the Space Launch System, has been quietly approved and funded by the House and the Senate and by an incredible bicameral, both parties agreeing on almost the only thing they could agree on in the entire Obama administration, which was to fund development of this new rocket system, which is basically an almost new version of the old Saturn V.
Well, what happened to that Ares system they were talking about?
Oh, that was killed because it was too big, too expensive, and it wouldn't have done the job. Right. Now what they're doing is they're taking the shuttle technology, they're rearranging it in a new form, which is cheaper than developing stuff from scratch, and it will have the capability of launching in phase one 70 metric tons into Earth orbit and ultimately 130 tons into Earth orbit, which allows you to send major payloads to the moon and to Mars. It is the building blocks for an ultimate manned Mars mission. The first test flights are supposed to be 2017. The first manned test flight around the moon could be as early as 2019, which would be exactly 50 years from Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin setting foot at Tranquility Base in July of 1969. Very nice anniversary. Remember, these guys like anniversaries as well as codes.
Can you believe it's already been 43 years?
No, not at all.
Unbelievable.
I can remember, like yesterday, everything that was going on and what Cronkite said to me and what I saw on the screens. And, you know, I mean, that's a whole other book. Anyway, here's what's interesting. Part of Zubrin's op-ed piece that he's really ticked off about, remember how he said in one line that we've replaced real missions with simulations?
Oh, yeah. He's livid, by the way.
Well, he, from his perspective, he has every right to be, because he's not in on the secret scenario, if I'm right, as most people in NASA are not. But here's what he lays out in his op-ed. He is furious that NASA is replacing real Mars missions, i.e. the follow-on to Curiosity, you know, collaborating with the Russians and with the Europeans and maybe the Chinese on going to Mars with more robots and picking up rocks and bringing them back. Sounds really exciting, right? What the Obama budget is proposing is that by 2016, they will be running simulations of a manned Mars mission, with due courtesy to all the women listening to this discussion.
Well, when you say man, you mean both.
I mean human, crude.
Yes.
It's very awkward phonetically to keep saying humaned or personed or, you know. Anyway, the point is they're going to be doing those in the space station as simulations of a manned mission to Mars in 2016. That's 1 year ahead of the first active launch of the new rocket, which can send humans to Mars if the Congress suddenly says, oh, my God, like Sputnik, we got to go. We got to get there before the Russians or the Chinese, et cetera, et cetera. I see a scenario building up like Sputnik 2, where Americans will be shocked. They'll be asked to do the right thing again and to make the major effort and to come from behind and to win, which is what we're very good at. We're not good at doing things in a day-to-day fashion. We're really good at digging ourselves out of a crisis.
Where would they go first on Mars? Where do you think?
Oh, obviously, if Curiosity reveals a stunning arcology full of artifacts,
robot
running around with 140-year nuclear-powered battery life, which is what this thing has, can you imagine a Sojourner and you know, Spirit and Opportunity, this thing going and going and going and going for decades?
Yeah, we don't have to worry about dust accumulating on the...
No, because it's nuclear powered. You don't care about the dust. You care about the optics and, you know, gears and wheels and motors and stuff like that. But these little robots, which were designed, remember, for 90 days.
Yeah, that's right.
Have now last 5 years.
That's right. One of them's still going, the other one's dead, right?
Maybe.
Maybe dead.
Maybe, because the other one, Spirit, landed in the middle of a whole bunch of artifacts that, frankly, I think they're secretly investigating close-up, and what better way to keep the secrets than simply telling everybody,
Sir Charles Schulz believes, as you do, that there's artifacts and fossils all over that planet.
Well, he's been reading our stuff. And I've been reading his. But, yeah, we were there first, and he followed on, has done excellent work. But, yeah, he's got photograph after photograph showing things that look stunningly like ancient fossilized life forms.
What was that little picture of what looked like a little ape man waving or just looking at a camera? Remember that one?
Well, I remember the so-called mermaid slash Bigfoot.
Yeah, that one.
Yeah, that was not, again, that was more disinformation.
Was it a statue?
Looks like a statue. I've done a very careful analysis with some of my colleagues, and I actually presented at one of the Whole Life Expos that Bob Quicksilver gives every year in Los Angeles, the actual data. And it was right after that Spirit had a malfunction and could not get close-ups. Isn't that convenient?
Isn't it? Now, are you telling me that this little picture was created, or
no,
was that
no.
object actually
there? Oh, no, it's there. And
it
a whole bunch
there.
Of other stuff. Okay. And before the spacecraft could get close, the rover could get close, NASA had a problem. It got stuck in a sand dune, and then it quietly and conveniently died.
Well, how big is the structure that we were looking at?
The actual physical thing they were exploring for the last several years, the size of a baseball field.
Well, the statue itself.
Oh, the statue itself was about 2.5 to 3 inches high.
That's all?
Well, now, wait a minute. There is a structure in Egypt called the Cheops Pyramid, the Great Pyramid, right?
Yeah.
Do you know the only surviving figurine carved out of ivory of Cheops is 3 inches tall? That's the only visible connection between that huge pyramid and the guy who ostensibly built it.
Huh.
And it was discovered at Abydos in a dig back in, I guess, the 1920s. It's literally 3 inches tall. And I have side by side a picture of that little statue of Cheops and the Martian figurine, which frankly is much more convincing because of shadows and detail. And she looks like, I think it's a she looks like the bronze mermaid statue in the harbor at Copenhagen.
It is weird. Richard, stay with us. We're going to come back in a moment and take phone calls with you. Questions with Richard C. Hoagland next.